You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person, too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in-line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.
One third of all murder cases in America remain open.
He had told me that if I opened my eyes, he would slit my throat.
Each one is called a cold case.
The DNA evidence taken from the victim was a match. The linen rapist was at it again.
Based on the hit A&E television program.
A phone call is placed, one that changes a family's life forever.
Cold Case Files, the podcast.
If you could see the fire in his eyes, he screamed at me. You want it? Get your tape recorder out.
Get new episodes of Cold Case Files every Tuesday on Podcast One, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 232 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, what's up, man?
Hey, man, I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm doing great.
Yeah?
And you're always doing good.
I'm doing good, man.
When are you going to be doing better than good? That's my question.
Soon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's get it rolling.
Yeah.
We need you there.
Well, next week you're attaching a lie detector test to my body.
I am. We're going to roll that out on Patreon. It's going to be a lot of fun.
For you.
For me.
Yeah.
And for everyone listening and viewing the video.
Yeah.
Speaking of Patreon, let's give our shout outs. We had Aaron Hartman.
Hey, Aaron.
Savannah Gladue.
Hey, Gladue.
Jake Brooks.
What's going on, Jake?
Patrick Campbell.
Hey, Patrick.
Kilgore Trout.
What's up, Kilgore?
Rebecca Cavanaugh.
Hey, Cavanaugh.
Sabrina Lassiter.
What's up, Lassiter?
Jason Spears.
Hey, Jason.
Matt Ring.
Appreciate that, Matt.
Kieran Hayden.
What's up, Kieran?
Casey Swanson.
Well, thank you, Casey.
Ben.
Hey, good old Ben.
Big Ben, Parliament. Mary Farron.
Hey, Mary.
Susan.
I appreciate that, Susan.
Cynthia Alcaraz.
Well, that's really close to that famous prison. Hi, Cynthia.
Hannah.
What's going on, Hannah?
Stephanie Eagle.
Hey, Stephanie.
Pete Corbett.
Appreciate that, Pete.
And Jana Stincliffe.
Well, look at you. There's Jana.
Look at you.
Look at you.
Then if we go back into the vault, Gibbs.
Yeah.
This week, we selected Nicole Flynn.
Well, hey, Nicole.
So we appreciate the new Patreon support, the continued support. We had PayPal donations from Kelly Baker.
Hey, Kelly.
Stacey O'Kelly.
Awesome.
And Julie Shantz.
Hey, Shantz.
So thanks to all of you as well. Gibbs, right now on True Crime All the Time, we have an episode out on William Huff, a teenager who murdered two girls and wrote to police calling himself the Phantom Killer.
Yeah, his own undoing.
That was a big part, wasn't it, of his undoing. All right, buddy, are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
Man, I am set.
We are talking about Dr. No, a man believed to be a long-haul truck driver who was killing women along the I-71 interstate corridor and leaving their bodies in his wake as he drove across the Midwest and East Coast from 1981 to 2004. That is a long time for a killer to operate.
It really is.
Almost all of his victims were sex workers who were lured from truck stops. Adopting the CB handle Dr. No, he left at least 9 victims horribly murdered in multiple states before he was stopped. So we know this guy was a serial killer. He meets all the requirements of that definition. Serial killers murder due to an abnormal psychological gratification, usually sexual in nature. The term serial homicide was first used in 1975 by FBI agent Robert Ressler. during a lecture at the Police Staff Academy in Bramshill, Hampshire, England. Now, to be fair, the concept was first conceived by a man named Ernst Skinnott to refer to killer Peter Curtin as a serial murderer all the way back in 1930.
And we did that case.
We did. According to the FBI, there are four broad classifications for serial killers that address the motivation for committing their crimes. They are mission-oriented, visionary, power control, and hedonistic. And Gibbs, this is nothing new. We've talked about these classifications in the past.
Right.
Mission-oriented serial killers believe that they're on a mission to rid the world of people that they deem undesirable, such as sex workers, the homeless, or those of a different race or religion. One example would be Gary Ridgway. Visionary serial killers are operating under the delusions of psychosis or other extreme forms of mental illness. One example would be Ed Gein.
That's a good example.
Ooh, that one was brutal. Power and control serial killers are motivated by seeking out the sexual pleasure received from conquering a victim's will. Gibbs, they literally get off by seeing that look of terror on the face of their victim, hearing their cries of pain and their hopeless struggles against their bonds, letting the killer know he has total control over the victim.
And boy, we've heard plenty of killers tell that story.
Oh, I mean, look at Ted Bundy, Ed Kemper. And then, you know, when you look at hedonistic serial killers, they murder their victims for material gain. And obviously you can have males in this category, but this is also where you can get into the Black Widows and other female serial killers like Eileen Wuornos, who killed her victims to steal their cars and the cash in their pockets.
Yeah, we did a big two-parter on that one, didn't
we? We did. And you can have men and women in both categories. I mean, I don't want to leave that out. So getting back to Dr. No, in the 1980s and 90s, sex workers and truckers, they were pretty intertwined, with many women targeting truck stops as ideal places to pick up dates. Truckers used CB radios to communicate with one another and with the public who happened to have them. Movies like Smokey and the Bandit popularized the CB and its unique vocabulary among the public. Sex workers at truck stops would give their CB handle and a code phrase to advertise services and their availability. An interested trucker would respond with his CB handle and location at the truck stop. When the date concluded, the woman would use the trucker's CB radio to radio her next customer and so on and so forth. The serial killer calling himself Dr. No on the CB also used the handle of Stargazer and Dragon when looking for dates over the CB radio.
CB radio, man. Handles are so cool. My dad had the handle of the judge. I think I told you that before.
I don't think you did.
Really? Yeah, he was the judge. I remember that as a kid. I'm like, why is he calling himself the judge?
I remember in the late 80s, kind of when I first started driving.
Yeah.
Obviously, this was before we all had cell phones, so my buddies and I, we all got CB radios installed in our cars so that we could talk to each other.
I can see that.
While we were driving around.
Yeah.
We thought we were Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah.
We thought we were cool.
What was your handle?
Honestly, I cannot remember, but I'm sure it was something unclever and unfunny.
Yeah.
So Gibbs, several young women started turning up dead throughout Ohio, most of them close to the Interstate 71 corridor that runs the length of the state from south to north. Because their killer left victims in different counties, the authorities didn't realize that a potential serial killer was on the loose in the state. It would take the investigative efforts and attention of a particularly clever journalist, a guy by the name of Michael Behrens of the Columbus Dispatch, to bring this fact to light. On March 10th, 1990, Behrens published his terrifying conclusions that a serial killer was at work and had already claimed six victims. He further theorized that he could link the killer to three more victims in neighboring states, a fact that ultimately turned out to be true. Once a serial killer theory was proposed, authorities And Ohio lost no time in organizing a task force with police agencies from six surrounding states to investigate the matter. So no doubt, Giz, I mean, this is fascinating that a journalist was able to piece all this together. You know, to be honest with you, it's not all that surprising. We've talked about it in many cases where jurisdictions, you know, I think it's hard for them sometimes to put pieces together that happen far away from them or even in neighboring jurisdictions. It just doesn't always happen.
Yeah, especially back in the 80s and 90s, right? Today we have more computerization, databases, things like that.
Yeah, and we're much more connected, right? In 2021, sometimes I think we're too connected, to be honest with you. So the task force is being formed. They're starting to investigate. In the meantime, the killer who called himself by his CB handle of Dr. No continued his gruesome trait of picking up women at truck stops and killing them in the safety of his truck cab before driving away to dump their remains in some other location. While the task force later admitted that they couldn't be sure about the number of murders attributed to this unknown serial killer, the Columbus Dispatch newspaper reported that they believed the first victim was discovered on April 24th, 1981, in Miami County, Ohio.
Now we're in my new backyard.
Close to where you live now.
Yeah.
An autopsy performed by the medical examiner showed that this woman had been strangled to death after receiving a brutal head injury inflicted by a blunt object, something like a pipe or maybe even a bat. No personal belongings or documents were found on or near the victim, making identification difficult. She was wearing a distinctive tasseled buckskin poncho and was given the placeholder name of Buckskin Girl until her real identity could be revealed. The Ohio Tribune reported in 2018 that she was finally identified as Marcia King of Arkansas. She was just 19 years old when she lost her life. And we actually talked about this woman, Marcia King, who was known as Buckskin Girl for many, many years in another episode. Marcia Matthews was the next victim tied to the series attributed to Dr. No. She was a 25-year-old sex worker who worked her trade around the Union 76 truck stop in Austintown, Ohio. It was reported in the Beacon Journal that Marcia was discovered on June 12, 1985 on I-71 just south of Ohio 97. She was found unconscious by state trooper Kevin Tilter, who was performing routine road stops looking for abandoned vehicles when he came upon the body of a young woman.
And she was found clinging to life. So the trooper gave her CPR until the paramedics arrived on the scene.
Yeah, and once first responders got there, they did everything they could to save her. They rushed her to the hospital. Marcia had a family who loved her, and she was the mother to an 8-year-old daughter. But just 2 days later, Gibbs, her family made the agonizing decision to disconnect her from life support, which at that point was the only thing keeping her alive.
Tough decision.
It's a very tough decision, and it's one I've never had to make. I hope I never do. Marcia's family donated as many organs and tissues as possible. Their hope was that something good would come from her heartbreaking death.
It's a good way to put a positive spin on something so negative.
It is. Deputies at the scene where Marcia Matthews was found at first thought it was just an isolated incident. They learned that she died because of a traumatic brain injury caused by a severe beating with a blunt object and that her personal belongings were missing. They thought most likely stolen by her killer. And I think that is the obvious conclusion to come to, just based on the fact that we've done so many cases,
right,
where killers have taken trophies, trinkets, whatever you want to call them. It's something that many of them revisit And from what we understand, it brings back the whole experience of the murder, the feelings that they got while they were committing the murder, just to handle whatever it is they took with them.
Yeah, article clothing or somebody's shoes.
Yeah, necklace, an earring. It can be a driver's license sometimes. Yeah. It can be quite a few different types of things.
We've even had some that have taken body parts.
A few days later, Trooper Tilter's boss, John Napier, was investigating Marsha's death. He talked to other women who worked the Union 76 lot and some truck drivers. One truck driver admitted to having contact with Marsha on the night of her murder. Now, he denied having sex with her. He said Marsha woke him up at 2:30 a.m., as he had requested, and he did not see her after that. And she was found just a few hours later. One sex worker said she observed Marsha getting into a semi with an Arkansas logo on the door, driven by an unknown man. But despite these leads and the presence of DNA, there was not much to go on. So there was DNA, Gibbs, but we have to keep in mind, this is very early days of DNA.
Very limited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, very early. I don't even know how many areas in the United States were really utilizing DNA in 1986. The Beacon Journal reported that on July 20th, 1986, 23-year-old Shirley Dean Taylor was also working at the same Union 76 truck stop near Austintown, Ohio. Other women working at that truck stop told authorities that Shirley met with a regular client that evening, a trucker who went by the CB name Dr. No. She then disappeared and was not seen for several days. A trucker who pulled into a rest area along I-71. Found the bathroom's lock, so he went looking for a discreet place to relieve himself.
As one would have to do.
We've all been there. He walked over to a concrete barrier, a short distance away from the rest area, and that's where he saw the decomposing body of a young woman, who was later identified as Shirley Taylor.
I tell you, anytime I stop anywhere, and I'm in an area like that, I always look around, because I'm like, I'm probably going to see something.
You might find something.
Yeah.
You might find something you don't want to find.
I know, but I think
if you keep looking.
Yeah, I keep looking.
Shirley's killer had removed her jewelry, pants, underwear, and shoes, and it's presumed by authorities that he kept these items as his personal souvenirs. A forensic examination revealed that Shirley had suffered severe injuries to her head and upper body before being suffocated, as evidenced by the ligature marks around her neck, like other victims in this series. Police again thought Shirley's death was an isolated incident, and they chalked it up to a common hazard of her profession. The cases might never have been linked as part of the same series if not for reporter Michael Behrens.
It really is a hazard of the profession. You hear about these type of cases all the time, back then, today.
And just think about how many cases we've profiled where serial killers have targeted sex workers. And we've talked quite a bit about the reasons for that. Sex workers are much more likely to get in a car with a stranger than people in other professions. That's just a fact. They're willing to go places that are private, secluded, more so than other people would. It's you know, again, like you said, a hazard of that job. While canvassing the truck stop for any witnesses to Shirley's death, a woman working at the truck stop said she heard Shirley being solicited over the CB radio that evening. The John called himself Dr. No. The Ohio Tribune reported that in December 1986, just 5 months after Shirley's murder, 18-year-old April Barnett went missing from a truck stop in Ashland, Ohio. Her body was found a few days later, 70 miles away from where she had been abducted. A forensic examination revealed that April had been strangled to death. Some of her clothing had also been taken. April's body was completely frozen. And obviously, Gibbs, this is December in Ohio.
Yeah, man.
So it gets very cold. I think that's an easy assumption to make, that it's due to winter conditions. April's pimp, Anthony Pickett, told police that he didn't know who April's last date was with, but a few days before her death, April had been beaten by a man whose license plate he had written down. Police tracked the plates to a 37-year-old named Alvin Wilden. But for some reason, unknown, I couldn't figure it out, they never interviewed this guy. When the agency was questioned years later about what happened, they cited an overwhelming number of leads and a lack of funding as the reason that they never followed up.
Going back to the pimp thing, isn't it the pimp's job to know where they're workers at all times and to protect them? Isn't that kind of like the main core thing of a pimp?
Well, that's my understanding. I've never been a pimp, so I can't speak from
pimpology.
Yeah. I don't have any of that specific knowledge, but I think as a police agency, when you're asked years later, hey, why didn't you follow up on this great tip? Somebody gave you a license plate number.
Yeah.
And you didn't go talk to this person. Well, you have to come up with some type of CYA.
Right.
An overwhelming number of tips and a lack of funding. Sounds pretty good to me.
Yep, sure does.
But it could also be true.
It could be.
That those two factors existed. A few days after April's murder, 28-year-old Jill Allen was found murdered in Illinois. Even though she was found in a different state, her death was linked to the series of Dr. No murders due to the same MO and the similarities to the previous four victims. Jill's shoes and underwear were never found, and investigators believe they were taken as souvenirs by her killer. So to me, Gibbs, it's apparent that we're dealing with a serial killer who takes souvenirs.
Absolutely.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I also think it's pretty common when you're talking about serial killers.
Yeah.
We hear it time and time again. Hey, TCAT fans, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you've heard me talk numerous times about how much I love Simply Safe. Imagine if every crime could be halted before it happened. Well, you can't stop every criminal in their tracks. What if you could deter them? That's what Simply Safe's new wireless outdoor security camera does. It's wireless, so you can install it anywhere, extending Simply Safe's perimeter of defense from your windows and doors to the far corners of your property. This camera is engineered with all of the advanced tech and security features you want and need to help keep you and your family safe. It has an ultra-wide 140-degree field of view so you can keep watch over your entire yard. It has a 1080p HD resolution with an 8x zoom. It even has a built-in spotlight with color night vision and two-way audio so you can speak to or even scare off someone who comes on your property. To learn more about the exciting new Simply Safe wireless outdoor security camera, simply visit simplysafe.com/TCAT. What's more, Simply Safe is celebrating this new camera by offering 20% off your entire new system and your first month of monitoring service free when you enroll in interactive monitoring. Again, that's simplysafe.com/TCAT. 27-year-old Anne Marie Patterson was the sixth victim in the series of tragic murders. The Columbus Journal newspaper reported that Anne Marie was abducted from the Union 76 truck stop in Austintown on February 7th, 1987. A week before her disappearance, Anne Marie had been arrested by police for loitering and solicitation. While police were questioning her, she told them she knew who was behind the many deaths of sex workers, but was afraid to tell them his name. Instead, she gave them the name he used on the CB radio, Dr. No. She also gave them a description of his rig. But incredibly, police ignored the information given to them by Anne Marie, a big mistake, a mistake that would cost several more women their lives.
So they had his name, his CB handle, and they know what his truck looked like. So why not keep an ear out for his handle coming across and then go surveil him?
I can't imagine it would have been that difficult to track this guy down by his CB handle and at the very least ask him some questions. So again, you and I, we try to be careful about bad-mouthing the police and what they do and what they don't do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
But you'd have to admit there's a couple of blunders here. These are leads that definitely should have been checked out and were not. So, Gibbs, I think what is unknown is whether this killer, who called himself Dr. No, targeted Anne Marie because he found out that she had supplied his identifying information to police, or whether she was targeted because she was a sex worker and he had no idea that she had given information to police. But her body was found 25 days later in a drainage ditch along I-71 north of Cincinnati, about 250 miles from where she was last seen. An autopsy showed that she was 6 months pregnant and she had been killed within 48 hours of her disappearance. Authorities also figured out that Anne Marie's body had been kept frozen for a month before she was dumped along the highway. It was theorized that she might have been kept in the killer's refrigerated truck or even some type of freezer chest. During the investigation into Anne Marie's murder, police detectives learned from her husband, who also served as her pimp, that she had been solicited via CB radio from a client calling himself Dr. No. I mean, we just got Dr. No all over the place.
Yeah, he's a busy guy.
And again, I'm going back to Dr. No, Dr. No, Dr. No. It's coming up in every investigation. Why are police not checking into this Dr. No? But Anne Marie, who went by the CB name Sleeping Beauty, refused to meet with him. She became so spooked that her husband drove her to a different truck stop just across the border in Pennsylvania. And Anne Marie described Dr. No in a very negative way to her fellow sex workers, but it's thought that he followed her that night. It was the last time she was seen alive, and her husband reported her missing a week later on Valentine's Day. So I've got a lot here, Gibbs. First of all, your husband is your pimp.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. How could you pimp out your wife? And especially, how could you pimp out your pregnant wife?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of hard for us to put ourselves in those shoes. And then she goes missing.
Yeah.
And her husband doesn't report her as missing until a week later, which happens to be Valentine's Day.
You would just think the husband would have more sense of urgency.
If he cared at all about his wife.
Yeah.
It's almost as if, oh, holiday rolled around. I just realized my wife's missing.
Yeah.
It's Valentine's Day. I better report her missing. There's just a lot of strange things here. The Columbus Journal reported that on August 10th, 1987, another woman was found dead in Englewood, Ohio, near Dayton. So very, very close to us. Very, very close to you.
Yeah. And really, really close to where I grew up at. This site was just down the road from my house.
The victim's jeans were pulled down around her ankles, while clothing from her upper body was missing from the discovery site. Forensic experts determined that the killer threw her body from his vehicle, according to the nature of the grass depressions and tire impressions. And this is definitely not the first time we've heard of this. Long haul truckers killing and then dumping the bodies of their victims from their truck. I know we did a case up in Canada.
We did, yeah.
Where it happened a lot. An autopsy revealed that the victim was a woman between the ages of 20 to 25 years old. She died from strangulation, but despite an abundance of tattoos and jewelry that the killer didn't steal, she remained unidentified until 2010, when it was learned that the victim was Paula Beverly Davis, who was 21 years old when she died. She was identified when relatives spotted her distinctive unicorn tattoos and a rose, one over each breast, on the missing and unidentified person's online system. And again, Gibbs, this is another victim that we've mentioned in a prior episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. This new information about Paula was presented to the task force, and they found that her death was related to the series and that Paula was likely a victim of Dr. No.
This Dr. No is definitely getting around.
He's a very bad guy. There's no doubt about that. The Ohio Tribune reported that another victim was discovered on November 22nd, 1987, at a truck stop in Breezewood, Pennsylvania, not all that far from the Ohio border. The victim was identified as LaMonica Cole, who was only 19 years old. She was found on a different interstate, but her death was linked to the Dr. No series when it was learned that she died from strangulation after being beaten with a blunt object and that some of her belongings had been taken. During the investigation, LaMonica's pimp, 24-year-old Derek Mims, told police that the alleged killer with whom LaMonica had been with was traveling in a blue Peterbilt semi-truck with white stripes.
Well, they have the description to go off of, which is helpful. I don't know how many blue Peterbilts with white stripes are out there, though. I'm guessing a whole bunch.
Probably a bunch. But could this also be the second time in this series of killings that police got a description of the killer's truck?
Could very well be.
It could, because we talked about someone else giving a description. We don't know what that description was, but it could have been the exact same one. The Beacon Journal reported that on March 29th, 1988, 31-year-old Terry Rourke was found murdered in New York on one of the bridges passing over the Mohawk River. Her death would later be determined to be part of the Dr. No series. The medical examiner reported that she had suffered traumatic brain injury sustained during a beating with a blunt object just a few hours before the discovery of her body. And like some of the other victims, Terry's belongings and some of her clothing were never found. She worked as a sex worker at truck stops in the Ohio-Pennsylvania border area.
I mean, we're seeing the same theme again and again, right?
Oh, yeah. And I think it's a big reason why ultimately these murders get linked to Dr. No. The Beacon Journal reported that on April 19th, 1990, the body of another young woman was found near a Pilot truck stop along I-71. Most of her clothes were missing. An autopsy showed that she had died from a traumatic brain injury that occurred in a severe beating with a blunt object, and that she had sexual intercourse 12 to 24 hours prior to her death. But despite efforts to learn her identity, she remained unidentified and was given the placeholder name Jane Doe Number 2. In 2017, she was identified as 29-year-old Patrice Marie Corley. Her identity was discovered using genetic DNA testing. Witnesses reported that the person Patrice was last seen with was driving a 1984 silver semi with a windbreaker and a red hood. They described this man as tall, he wore glasses, had dark hair and a light complexion, and he spoke with a northeastern accent.
That northeastern accent, huh? Is that a Boston?
I don't know. There's a lot of areas that encompass the Northeast, so you're being very specific with the Boston. The thing that I take away from this is that the description of the semi is definitely different.
True. But it's also years later.
And I think that's important. 3 years. Okay. I don't know how often drivers change trucks. Do they own the truck? Are they driving for another company?
Right. Leasing.
I don't know.
Yeah.
My thought is, if you're a serial killer who is using your truck to lure and murder and dispose of your victims, you would probably find a way to switch trucks on a regular basis if that's possible.
Yeah, if you don't want to be caught, you better figure something out. You better switch it up.
5 days after journalist Michael Barron's expose in the Columbus Dispatch in March 1990, the Ohio Attorney General convened a task force with investigators from six states to investigate the string of murders attributed to the killer, calling himself Dr. No. Barron's also identified three additional victims, two from Illinois and one from New York, who police later linked to the series. And when authorities investigated Barron's claims, they discovered even more than the three that he theorized as cold cases that may be the work of the elusive Dr. No. So Gibbs, now I think we have to talk about possible suspects. There were many potential suspects that came up as the task force investigated the many unsolved deaths of women in nearby states, even more victims than had been initially proposed by Michael Barron's. Thousands of volunteers assisted Ohio State Police in spreading warnings to sex workers at truck stops throughout the state and even beyond into neighboring states. They offered a five-figure cash reward for information leading to the identity and arrest of the killer who called himself Dr. No. The task force also learned of a concerning incident in 1987 when Dr. No was in the midst of his killing spree. They learned about an accident involving a semi on I-71. The truck slid on a patch of ice and hit a bridge. When it crashed, more than 200 pieces of women's clothing fell from the truck cab, in addition to leather restraints, chains, handcuffs, and a lot of pornographic magazines.
Well, that's a lot of clothing coming out of the truck. 200 pieces? That's a heavy dry cleaning day.
Well, and if you look at it, it's women's clothing. You have a male driver. When you add in, you know, some of the kind of BDSM type stuff that flew out.
That flew right out of your mouth. Really, it did. Too, right off that tongue.
I'm not even sure if I'm using it correctly, sure. But we'll see.
Yeah.
People always tell me, no, you're using this or that incorrectly. But
I do know that you guys have this one room here.
That's sealed off.
That's sealed off, that you have to have a special code to punch in and get into the room.
Yep.
So
we don't talk about that.
Yeah.
But when you add it all together, you're going to want to talk to this driver. Why do you have 200 pieces of women's clothing in your truck cab?
And I don't know, once you fill us in a little bit on these leather restraints and chains, I don't know.
Sure. Just,
pacify me.
Hey, what you want to do in your own free time, as long as you're not hurting anyone else, that's fine. But we're probably going to want to ask you some questions. Now, this driver was critically injured, taken to the hospital. His wife provided him an alibi during the Dr. No killing, saying he was on disability from work. He was home every day during those time periods. She also explained that the clothing found was hers and said her husband must have taken it by mistake when he went to do his laundry. Now, it's thought that no one investigated whether the clothing was all the same size or maybe whether it was a bunch of different sizes. Eventually, the clothing and other items were returned to the driver and nothing further was done.
So really, we'll never know the total truth.
No, I mean, you can take her alibi on face value. The problem is, and we've seen this recently in cases, spouses giving alibis that later turn out to be false.
Right, yep. Years later, they recant them.
Yes, it happens. And again, I go back to this. Why not take that one extra step? Take a look at the clothing. Is it all the same size or, roughly the same size? Does it match her size? Or is it just like a hodgepodge of a whole bunch of different sizes? Well, then it doesn't look good.
No.
It doesn't seem to match what is being told. The other thing that kind of jumped out at me, and I know truckers can be gone for long periods of time. How long do you need to be gone to take 200 pieces of clothing? And on top of that, inadvertently take your wife's clothing instead of your own. For me, doing laundry, separating clothes, it's pretty easy for me to tell what is mine and what is my wife's. First of all, I'm twice her size.
Right.
And, just by the patterns, and I know what I wear.
I mean, if you think about it, you wear five pieces of clothing maybe per day. So 25 pieces
per day. Well, why would I wear five?
Well, jeans, shirt,
underwear.
Underwear.
That's three.
Socks.
That's three.
Socks.
Well, for me, I usually don't even wear socks.
Maybe a t-shirt underneath your shirt.
No, three.
Okay.
Three. I'm going with three.
So, but that is a lot. 200 pieces.
Yeah.
Would be a lot of clothing to be taken to the laundry.
Well, even based on your five a day.
Yes.
That means you're going to be gone for 40 days without coming home. I know truckers are gone a lot, but I'm not sure it's 40 days at a time.
I'm pretty sure they're doing some laundry in between.
Yeah. So I don't know. Some things with that just don't add up, but there's no way for us to really know because I just don't think it was investigated. In 1991, the Cleveland Plain Dealer reported on a suspect that state police were investigating. 36-year-old Alvin Wilson was investigated as possibly being responsible for this series of murders. Wilson was from Lake County, Ohio, and authorities found hairs on some of the victims that matched his hair. His credit card purchases also put him in the area of a few of the murders at the time that some of these women disappeared. In 1989, he was arrested for assault and attempted murder of a woman. The victim told police that in 1986, Wilson picked her up in Akron and he beat her and attempted to strangle her. Wilson was tested for his involvement in the Dr. No murders, but the results were inconclusive.
So he could have hired these women?
Yes.
And that's how the hairs transferred?
Yes, that I was thinking that exactly. You know, this transference of that type of evidence, it does happen. And, you know, if you're a trucker, if you're visiting these same truck stops and you are using the services provided by these women.
Right.
Maybe in the day before the days leading up to their disappearance, I could see how it could happen.
Right. Sure. The other thing is that you could potentially have more than one killer. I mean, she said that he tried to attack her and strangle her. Well, maybe that's something that he does, but Dr. No does as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of killers who beat and strangle.
Right.
So it is possible that you could have multiple killers using a very similar MO. We know that.
Exactly.
They could also there could also be multiple truck drivers.
Yeah.
Using a very similar MO. John Fountainberry was a convicted killer who was also investigated for the crimes. He was a long-haul trucker convicted of murdering five victims from across the United States in the late 1980s. He was put to death by lethal injection in 2009. The Ohio Tribune reported that he was ultimately dismissed as a suspect when it was discovered that Fountainberry's victims had all been men, and the methods used to kill them had been very different from those used by Dr. No. So I get that, right? You know, just based on the fact that these are all men, right, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
No.
That somebody would all of a sudden switch and now start murdering a series of women. James Robert Cruz was also investigated as a potential suspect because he was a trucker who had murdered a woman that he picked up from a truck stop in Western Pennsylvania. He had stolen some of her clothing after the murder. But despite some similarities, there really wasn't much more that tied Cruz to this series of crimes.
Just another bad guy.
28-year-old Sean Patrick Goble admitted to killing sex workers in Tennessee in 1995. It was reported on CDL Life that he was a long-haul trucker who ran freight all over the Midwest. Goble denied having anything to do with the Dr. No murders, and it was later learned that he was serving in the military far away from the Ohio area when most of the murders took place.
So that right there rules him out.
Yeah, I think it does. If you're known to be, you know, halfway across the world when these things happen, it's pretty hard for you to have done them. DNA evidence did bring Delmas Coleman to justice in 2005 when he was arrested for murdering seven sex workers between New Jersey and Ohio. Coleman later confessed to killing 52 women and girls from the mid-1980s to 2005, and his victims were abducted from all around the country. But according to the Beacon Journal, despite his confession, he was ruled out as a suspect in the Dr. No series of murders due to the evidence in the seven murders he was tied to. We don't know what that evidence was, but I'm assuming it was very different from what was discovered in the Dr. No series.
But 52 murders that he confessed to. Now, that's him saying that he...
Sure, but, you know, who knows? We have not profiled him yet on True Crime All the Time, but it sounds like someone we need to do. The Beacon Journal reported that on February 14th, 2019, 49-year-old Samuel Legg was arrested and stood before a judge in a Medina County courtroom for the rape of a 17-year-old girl near a truck stop 22 years ago outside of Seville, Ohio. Just hours after that, investigators in Mahoning County announced Legg's indictment for the murder of Sharon Lynn Kidzierski, who was found dead at the Union 76 in Austintown in 1992. Sharon was hitchhiking home from her boyfriend's house in Cleveland when she went missing, and she was later found murdered. She had been beaten, strangled, and articles of her clothing were missing. So no doubt Gibbs, the MO, is right on the money here. The Beacon Journal reported that in 1990, Legg was a suspect in the murder of his 16-year-old stepdaughter, and that investigator said DNA also tied him to the death of a woman in Chandler, Arizona, where Legg was living when he was arrested. He was also tied to two victims in Ohio and one in Illinois, but those victims haven't yet been officially named. Legg was originally identified through genetic genealogy, and while he was indicted in the Dr. No series of murders, he was found to be incompetent to stand trial and unable to participate in his defense. He was sent to a psychiatric hospital for treatment. So as it stands right now, it's unclear whether or not he's the killer who called himself Dr. No. We're not going to have any of those answers until Samuel Legg is deemed competent to stand trial and all of the evidence comes out at his trial. But there's no doubt this is a bad guy.
Oh, for sure.
And some of the murders that he is known to have committed have a very, very similar, if not exact, MO as the murders committed in the Dr. No series.
But what's scary is, as bad as he is and these other guys that we've talked about are, maybe this Dr. No is still out there.
Maybe. The one thing that did jump out at me about Legg is that he killed a woman that he picked up at the Union 76 in Austintown.
Right.
So, you know, that's a very specific truck stop where a number of Dr. No's victims were taken.
Absolutely.
So this is unsolved, but I think a lot of people, Gibbs, really looking at this Samuel Legg, you know, you have genetic genealogy involved. Obviously, police authorities have something. We just don't know what it is because there's been no trial yet.
Right. They're not going to release that until they can get a chance to go to trial.
No. So we don't know how strong it is, but I will say all of these cases recently that have been solved using genetic genealogy, it's been pretty airtight.
Yeah.
You know, what they've used to convict these people with or, you know, get a plea with, it's been pretty compelling. But we'll just have to wait and see.
They're going in there pretty confident.
But like you said, if it's not Samuel Legg, then it's possible that this Dr. No is still on the loose, still targeting women in the Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Arizona areas. anyone with information on any victims or suspects in this series of murders is urged to contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS or the Ohio State Police at 614-466-2660. So Gibbs, that's it for our episode on Dr. No. It's unsolved. You could also maybe consider it unresolved,
right?
Because there might be a resolution sometime in the near future if this guy is deemed fit to stand trial.
It's a big if.
It is. We got some voicemails. You want to check those out?
Let's hear them.
Hey, Mike and Mike. This is John from up north of the west coast of Vancouver. Long time listener, first time caller. I just wanted to give you guys a shout out. I love you, what you're doing. It's always good, but man, I just listened to everything. I went back and now I'm listening to like episode 50 of Unsolved, and Gibby, man, I want to hear your baritone voice more often. It's nice. And then the later ones, not so much, but yeah, I don't have anything cases to suggest, but man, we're talking about housing prices near Vancouver, and $1 million here basically gets you a hovel. So yeah, things are different up here for sure, but don't live in fear, but keep your own time ticking. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm like a little hobble for $1 million.
Did you say hobble?
Yeah,
it's hovel.
What do you say?
H-O-V-E-L.
Oh, I thought he was using some fancy Vancouver term.
No. Oh, you crack me up. Let's hear more of that baritone.
That baritone. Bring it on.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. JoJo here from Southern California. Just finally caught up with all TCAT episodes, and I'm very, very excited to start TCAT Unsolved. Just wanted to let you guys know that you guys are doing a great job. Love listening to the podcast. Love the banter between Mike and Gibby. Keep it up. Thank you.
Oh, appreciate the kudos very much. So just starting Unsolved. Sometimes I like to put these voicemails, it'll be like a little Easter egg.
Yeah.
That she'll kind of maybe forget and then hear when she gets to this episode.
Boom, like that.
Boom.
Yeah.
I remember when I did that.
Yeah, remember that time?
Remember that one time?
Yeah.
In band camp?
Don't bring that up again.
Hi, Mike and Givi. This is Karen from Hollywood, Florida, originally from Colombia. I've left a message before, but the reason that I'm calling you now is because I listened to the episode where in Iceland, where the prisons, the jails, they focus on reform instead of punishment. And actually, I recommend that you watch Toughest Prisons in the World. It's a documentary. It's not a documentary. It's a show in Netflix with Raphael Rowe. And they actually show the jail in Iceland and how they reform the prisoners. I think it's a really, really good show. It's called Toughest Prisons in the World with Raphael Rowe. Thank you, and keep your own time ticking. Bye.
All right. Love those recommendations.
We do.
You and I watch a lot of Netflix. We're always talking about what we're watching on Netflix.
We do.
And, you know, that's something that we could use potentially in a future episode.
Yeah.
Right. Garnering information that we don't currently have that we can then later use. It's always good.
You're exactly right. As always.
As always. All right, buddy. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.